Welcome to Nightlife, the podcast.
Lindsay McDougall here. Welcome to Nightlife. Now, you may be wondering who owns this strange voice. What is going on? This is not my beautiful house. This is not my beautiful Philip Clark. Look, you're right. My name is Lindsay McDougall. Today, we're starting on a journey into the world of mushrooms and fungi. Do you know, fungi are more closely related to you and I than they are to plants? I know, isn't that amazing? They look a little bit like broccoli, I suppose, some of them. But they're not. They're much closer to us. And there are some species so big, they extend over kilometres of forest. There's even one fungus in Oregon, in the US, that's so big, it could be a contender for the largest organism on Earth. Time to dip into the world of fungi, of mushrooms, of mycelium, with the author of Entangled Life, How Fungi Make Our Worlds, Change Our Minds, and Shape Our Futures. British biologist and fungi aficionado Merlin Sheldrake, who I believe caught while he was in Australia in hotel quarantine for quite an interesting reason.
I'm working on a documentary about fungi with an Australian team in the Tasmanian forests, which is very exciting.
Wow. All right. I'm very excited to hear more about that later. But I want to start with fungi today, like outside the human body, outside animal bodies, fungi around us. So I guess when we think fungi, a lot of people think mushrooms, but that is just the beginning, right?
That's right. Yes. Or the end. But it's mushrooms are the fruiting bodies of fungi. And most fungi live most of their lives not as mushrooms, but as mycelial networks, which are branching, fusing networks of tubular cells.
And these have been around, like take us right back, before our land had any living things on it, before any plants, certainly before animals. What was fungi doing then?
So if you went back about 500 million years ago, this was the time when the earliest ancestors of green plants were starting to move onto land out of fresh water. The land was very inhospitable then. Most life was taking place in the sea. And so on land, there was some microbial crusts. There was some lots of rocky, powdered rocky surfaces, but not much that we would recognize as life on land today. But in these earliest moments, the algal ancestors of green plants started washing up onto the soggy shores of lakes and rivers. And they were faced with a whole new challenge when they came into the open air, because when they were floating around in the water, they would photosynthesize. They would eat light and carbon dioxide from the air to produce energy, but they still needed nutrients. But those nutrients would just sort of drift into them if they were floating around in a nutrient broth, essentially. But when they come onto land, they have a challenge of how to find their nutrients. They're not equipped to scavenge in the soil. And so at this moment, they struck up a relationship with fungi, and fungi are able to explore the soil ingeniously in the form of these mycelial networks, and struck up a trading relationship with the plants. And so over time, this relationship became what we now call mycorrhizal relationships. And to this day, almost all plants depend on fungi that live in and around their roots.
Yeah, in fact, some people think the roots of plants are really kind of just like power adapters for fungi to then zoom on out and grab stuff for them.
Well, certainly in the earliest days, that's how it was, because the ancestors of plants didn't have roots. Oh. And so for the first 50 million years or so of life on land, fungi were their root systems. And so that makes mycorrhizal fungi a more fundamental part of planthood than leaves or wood or fruit.
You say in your book at one point that the harder parts of plants, the roots and stems and that, were kind of developed to house the fungi?
Well, roots were, in the earliest days of roots, certainly. And so, and to this day, you can see in some plants which have a very high dependence on their fungal partners. If you look inside their roots, they have very reduced root systems, and their roots are really kind of fungal farms, just big cavernous spaces packed with fungi. The roots themselves are no use for absorbing anything from the soil. They're too shrunken.
And I know wood wide web is a very fun term, but it is appropriate in a couple of ways, because tell me about the hackers in the wood wide web that hack into the mycelium to do the work for them.
So maybe first just brush up on the wood wide web,
yes,
which is a name given to shared networks of mycorrhizal fungi. So plants are promiscuous and they can form relationships with more than one fungus. Mm. And fungi too are promiscuous and can form relationships with more than one plant. And what you end up with in natural ecosystems is fungal networks that connect different plants together and plants that connect different fungal networks together. And this is what's termed the wood wide web. It's a sort of social network of plants and fungi. And so there's lots of ways that this can behave. Sometimes nutrients can pass between plants. Sometimes signaling compounds can pass between plants. Sometimes poisons can pass between plants. And so it's a really astonishing new biological possibility, not new for the plants and fungi that are part of these networks, but new for humans to think about. So I studied some plants which have lost the ability to photosynthesize. They don't have leaves anymore, and they don't have green anymore. Mm. And they're very striking, charismatic plants that I was interested in because they found a way to make a living not by photosynthesizing themselves, but by plugging into fungal networks, which are then connected to plants that are photosynthesizing. Mm. So these plants exist by pulling their carbon compounds and their nutrients from other plants via fungal networks. And because of the way that they behaved, not appearing to give anything back to the fungi, I started calling them hackers of the wood wide web.
I just remember learning about photosynthesis, learning about that's how plants do things when we're kids, and this is a whole very different way to do it. But how do fungal hyphae know where to go? Like, can they see? What senses do fungi have?
So fungi have all sorts of senses. They're sensitive to light, to gravity, to all sorts of different chemicals. Their chemical sense is very important, and to acidity, to oxygen levels, carbon dioxide levels. And so when hyphae are navigating through the bustling wilderness that is the soil, they use all sorts of different cues. One, chemical cues are very important, gradients of chemicals that they can follow gradients to get to different places. So a plant root, for example, might be producing certain chemicals which diffuse out from the root, and the fungus might pick up those chemicals and grow towards the root, and then might start producing chemicals that might influence the behavior of the root, which in turn produce other chemicals which would influence the behavior of the fungus. So there's these kind of chemical conversations that take place. As fungi are navigating the soil.
I'm speaking to Merlin Sheldrake. His book, Entangled Life, How Fungi Make Our Own Worlds, Change Our Minds and Shape Our Futures. Tell me something about some of the experiments on fungal networks, on these hyphae that, for example, Lynn Boddy at the Cardiff University did.
Yeah, Lynn does wonderful work on the foraging behaviours of wood-rotting fungi. And so wood-rotting fungi make their living by decomposing wood. That's how they feed. And so wood is food for them. And so what Lynn does is, well, in a series of experiments, what she did was to put a block of wood that had a fungus living inside it and put the block of wood on a dish or a plate. And then the fungus would grow out from the block of wood in all directions, forming a kind of fuzzy white circle. If you were dropped off in the desert and had to look for water, you'd have to pick one direction and explore that direction and then come back and then set off to explore another direction. But fungi don't have that limitation. They can grow in all directions at once. So the fungus grows out in all directions at once. And at some point, one part of that mycelial network encounters another block of wood. And at that point, the behavior of the whole network changes. The fungus strengthens the connections with the new block of wood and withdraws from the other parts. And so what this shows is that even though fungal networks seem to be amorphous, like cotton wool, they are actually integrated wholes that are able to coordinate their behavior as a single integrated entity.
Yeah, somehow like a bunch of birds turning midair, like a flock of birds or something like that, they all kind of, the message gets to all elements of it. And then there was a cool trick. There was a way of proving that they kind of remembered where to go as well.
Yes, when she pulled out the original block of wood from that experiment. So after the fungus had a chance to find the new block of wood and had a chance to strengthen its connections with that new block of wood, then she pulled out the original block and severed the network from all of the sides of the block of wood and put it onto a new dish. And the fungus grows out in the same direction as the new block of wood, which suggested there's some kind of memory in the network. How this works, we're not sure.
There's a lot about fungi that I guess the human world isn't sure about, though, isn't there?
It's amazing, actually. Yeah, our ignorance is easily summarized. There are an estimated 2 to 3 million species of fungi, and we've only described about at most 8%.
So we talk about the senses that they have, the kind of has a memory, knows where to go. Can fungi feel? And I mean, like, is there like a subgroup of extreme vegans that don't eat fungi?
Well, I'm not sure. I haven't met any. I think if you eat plants, then you should have no problem eating right. fungi, especially because the fruiting bodies of fungi or the mushrooms that we tend to eat that want to be eaten, if you like, because they're the parts of fungi that are spreading their spores. And so when you eat these mushrooms, you're participating in the life cycle of the mushroom, rather like eating a plant fruit where you're spreading its seeds, and we're playing our part in that plant story.
Exactly, yeah, you're making us feel better about it. We're doing the job for them. There's those beautiful fruits, we're eating them. We are kind of, in a way, being influenced, having our behaviours influenced by the fungi, but that is another discussion, I suppose. Look, I know that you eat mushrooms because I saw you grow those oyster mushrooms out of the first print of your book, and then you ate them. Did that sort of come to you as you were printing it, or have you always dreamt of doing that with your first book?
Well, no, it came to me when I was finishing writing the book, actually, because I'd been spending so much time in front of a computer, locked in a room, you know, not much time outside, and I felt so abstracted from my subject matter. I think it's very easy to become to sort of separate ourselves from the living world when we talk about it, as if it's outside, as if it's somewhere else. And so I wanted to find some kind of remedy for my abstraction. I thought the best way to do that would be to grow mushrooms on the book itself so that they could eat my words, and then eat the mushrooms that grew from the book so then I could eat my words too. And I could fold myself back into these biological cycles that I'd spent so much time describing.
Dorgan and Merlin Sheldrake, we were just talking about, I guess, perhaps the mushrooms influencing us to eat them, like lots of plants influence bees and lots of insects to take their fruit and spread their seeds. But I guess when we talk about fungi inside us and inside every other living creature, can we talk about this story? And I know you've told it a lot, about what happens when the innocent carpenter ant comes in contact with a certain fungi.
Yeah, so there are whole groups of fungi that make their living by growing into the bodies of insects or arthropods and manipulating their behavior in such a way that the insect or arthropod spreads the fungus's spores for it. And this has evolved multiple times in different corners of the fungal world. And one of these species that do this is called Ophiocordyceps. It's a fungus that grows into carpenter ants. And carpenter ants, normally, their instinct is to stay low in the forest floor, stay out of sight, makes sense. But when they're infected by this fungus, the fungus starts growing through their body, and it influences their behavior. And the fungus really takes over. It starts driving. And it causes the ant to become fascinated by heights, which is a syndrome known as summit disease. And so the ant then climbs upwards, having had its instincts overridden by the fungus. And then at a certain point, about 15 centimeters above the forest floor, having climbed up the shoot of a plant, it then bites on to the underside of a leaf in what's called the death grip. And then out of its head, the fungus pushes a stalk, which then rains down spores on hapless ants passing below. And it's a really fascinating a situation, because really these are fungal behaviors, the summit disease, the death grip, these are the fungal behaviors. It's not ant behaviors. It's like the fungus, as David Hughes, who's a prominent researcher in this field, he calls infected ants a fungus in ants' clothing. I think this is a very helpful way to think about it. And it calls to mind all of these mythical stories that we hear about organisms transforming into one another, or you know, sphinxes or chimeras, which are half one animal and half another.
Like half a fungus and half a cicada flying through the air with its bum falling off, I believe, is another one of these effects.
That's right. Yeah, it's a very grisly litany of techniques.
Was it the flying salt shaker of death, I think?
That's right, yeah.
What, I mean, I have heard of other parasites that do this. There's a crab that gets completely overtaken by a parasite as well and possessed by it to turn into a reproductive womb for it. Why? What is the? I guess I can see the evolutionary advantage, but why would a fungus decide to do this, or why was this the easiest way to spread its spores?
Well, there are so many advantages to having an animal body. You know, animal bodies can walk and bite and fly, and we take our ability to move around for granted. And fungi and plants, which don't walk or bite or fly, they have great advantages too from having the way that they live in a very indeterminate way. You know, they don't have fixed body plans. They can regenerate from tiny little parts of their body into a whole new organism, unlike us. So they have great freedom in a developmental sense, but they don't have these animal locomotive freedoms. And so I think of it as a way that the fungus can get the benefit of animal bodies for this short while, to when they really need to disperse, which is that they need to travel from one place to another. And then they can return to their fungal life after they've discarded this animal body once they've used it for their short while. But when you have the cicadas, then it's quite clear, because these will be flying around in a very characteristic sort of lurching flight pattern, which is the fungus flying. Fungus is in the cockpit there.
Yeah.
But then out of this back end, broken back end of the cicada, is pouring spores. And so this flight is a fantastic way to just make sure that the spores are spreading all over, all over, not just anywhere, spreading where the cicadas like to spend time. Same with the ants. The ants,
so they control it. They go to certain places. And this is just a natural selection, evolutionary trait that they've evolved to do this. I mean, I'm not suggesting that there was any free will involved, but you know what I mean? Like, that this was the best way for them to do it.
Totally. It's obviously a very effective method, because many different fungal lineages have reached the same conclusion, but in different ways. And when you see these examples of evolutionary convergence, normally it means there's a good idea in an evolutionary sense.
I'm speaking to Merlin Sheldrake. We're talking about insects, arthropods, being possessed by fungus, like a demon or a spirit possesses a human. Now, there are a lot of fungi inside humans. Are fungi controlling us?
good question. Well, certainly we have many organisms living in and on us, trillions. And actually we carry around more cells, more microbial cells, bacterial and fungal cells, than we do our own cells. So this raises all sorts of questions about who we are. And I think of ourselves, like all other organisms, as walking ecosystems. But these microbes that live in us, in our guts, they don't just sit there. Without these microbes, we wouldn't grow and behave as we do. And a whole new field has just recently begun in the biological sciences called neuromicrobiology. And what neuromicrobiology studies is the way that the microbes that live inside us, how they influence our nervous system and our behaviors.
It's like the gut microbiome, sort of gut-brain connection, that kind of stuff.
Exactly, the gut-brain connection, the microbiome gut-brain axis. And so there are all sorts of ways that that these microbes seem to be able to influence our behavior. And it's a really exciting field of study. But it suggests that, yes, that the microbes that live on us do have an ability to alter the way that we behave and feel. How exactly this is taking place is, there's still lots of questions about it, but it's analogous to the ways that fungi would grow into an insect and change its behavior. But it's less, perhaps.
Yes, perhaps. I'm not biting onto the top of a plant or anything, as far as I know, not so far anyway. Although you do talk a little bit about people purposely taking mushrooms to affect their behaviour, at least. I mean, you call it being under the influence, and psilocybin, which is the active ingredient in magic mushrooms. I guess that is, a form of being influenced very much sort of on purpose by fungi.
Yeah, when you eat magic mushrooms, then you fall under the influence of a fungal set of fungal chemicals. Of course, there's a big difference with the insect possessing fungi, because they get on to live and make a life and grow actively within the body of the animal. Whereas when we eat magic mushrooms, on the whole, we're eating mushrooms which don't go on to live inside us. We're just digesting them through our normal digestive pathway.
I mean, when people who do trip, take psychedelics, they talk about that feeling of connectedness. And I love how that kind of links up with the mycelial networks, which are all about connectedness. Like
it's funny, isn't it? It's fungi in so many ways. They challenge our concepts of individuality, autonomy, independence. And when people take psychedelic mushrooms, a very common experience that's reported is a feeling of ego dissolution, it's sometimes called, or losing track of where you end and where your surroundings begin. And so our sense of self, our sense of a neatly identifiable self, can be melted by these psychedelic experiences. And it's just another way in which fungi challenge our sense of self.
Yeah, I've read a few books to do with, I guess, the history of mushrooms and even organized religion. There's a book called Sacred Mushroom and the Cross, suggesting that Christianity was actually a form of a mushroom cult, and Jesus is actually an allegory for a magic mushroom. Have you come across that one?
Yeah, I have come across that one. I'm not hugely convinced by Allegro's thesis in that book, but a book that came out recently, which I find very interesting, is called The Immortality Key by Brian Murarescu, and he explores the psychedelic origins of Christianity in a very compelling way. And I definitely recommend that.
Well, you may not go for this next one that my wife heard the other day, that Santa Claus, not Jesus Christ, but Santa Claus could actually have come from another hallucinogenic mushroom, the Amanita muscaria. They grow under pine trees, hence the presence under the Christmas tree. This is just a text that my wife sent me. And shamans used to brew them in yurts, and the way to get into the yurts was through the chimney. So there is some connections to Santa Claus there.
There are so many stories about the red and white spotted mushroom, the Amanita muscaria. It's really featured in folklore for so long. And there are so many tales told. The Father Christmas story, I'm just not sure. You know, I heard that the origins of that were from Robert Graves, the poet and scholar, who was very enthusiastic about psychedelic mushrooms, but often sort of wildly speculated about different things. And I heard from one place that this arose from one of Robert's speculations. I'm sure there are other tracings of that story back, and maybe there's some truth in it.
But I'm being one of those guys, aren't I, that comes up to Merlin Sheldrake and starts yelling theories about mushrooms to him, which I'm sure happens a lot.
No, don't worry. It's fun.
I'm speaking to Merlin Sheldrake, and you are currently in a quarantine hotel. You're making your way to Tasmania to look at some of the beautiful fungi that we have across Australia. Have you had a good look, or do you know what you're in for in Australia? Is there much difference in the type of fungi networks that there are in Australia?
Well, there are lots of species that I won't have met before, so I'm very excited to explore these forests in the Tarkine. And so a lot will be new to me. And it will be exciting to go there after being in a hotel for 2 weeks in a hotel room. It's a bit like, have you heard those stories about monks who walk around with weights on their feet for months on end, and when you take them off, there's this great sense of being able to almost fly. And I think being kept in a little room and then being released into the Tarkine, these magnificent forests, is maybe a little bit like that. And I think it will enhance the experience.
Are you peeling up the carpet, looking around, looking for mycelial networks yet?
No, not yet, thankfully.
Although I did see, speaking of the wood wide web, you've kind of made the fashion world as well.
I was excited to see that Iris Van Herpen, the designer, had been inspired by Entangled Life to create a fungal collection for her earlier this year. Lots of really astonishing comments.
Yeah, it looks like there's the mushroom fruit sort of out the front of the dress, and probably not what you expected when writing the book.
Not at all. I was very happily surprised.
Wonderful. Oh, also, what is next, do you think, I guess, in mycelial research? What's the next thing that people are going to realise?
Well, there's a huge explosion of interest in fungi right now, and there's research growing out in all sorts of directions, which is really exciting because fungi have been neglected historically, relative to animals and plants. So I'm really excited to see what will happen. And it's very hard to predict. You know, we know that fungi connect plants together outside, but we know very little about what these networks are actually doing in the field or in the forest, because it's very hard to measure these transfers through these networks in situ. So much of what we know comes from greenhouse experiments or lab experiments, and so I'm excited to see what happens as we become able to find out more about what they're doing in real ecosystems. On the whole, the more we find out about fungi, the more astonishing things get. So it's a great subject.
If we can actually hack into the actual wood wide web and listen and see what's going on, what's being spread between them. Wow. Merlin Sheldrake, thank you for taking some time out from your very busy time sitting in a hotel room. And
Well, thanks for having me. It's been great to chat.
You're listening to Nightlife with Lindsay McDougall across ABC Radio.
And thank you for the people. Very interested. Quirky. Very interesting. Speaking about mycology, says Quirky. He wasn't saying it's quirky. Lindsay McDougall here sitting in for Phil Clark. Someone says, filling Tony Delroy's boots is a big ask. Absolutely. I wish you all the best. Welcome to the Nightlife program. Thank you very much. And we've had a couple of mushroom-based calls as well. Anthony, where are you calling from?
Oh, I'm calling from central Victoria. Beautiful, freezing cold and very wet and frosty and icy at the moment.
Probably not a bad, not too bad to be locked inside then, locked down.
Oh, well, you know, lockdown's lockdown. We've been through it five times.
Yeah. Oh, that's so true. That's so true. Now, before all that, though, you used to work in a botanic garden with full of mushrooms.
Oh, well, that's right. You know, it was in Castlemaine.
Yeah, beautiful.
And, there was, you know, it's a wonderful old botanic garden established in, 1850s or so.
Right.
And I think many of the plants that they put there had the mycelium around their root systems. And we had everything from death caps to, you know, fly agarics and everything in between. Very edible, very non-edible too.
Yeah, right. And you knew, of course, or you learnt the difference?
Yeah, that's right. There was a couple of experts, you know, that... would show you which mushrooms were safe to take home and cultivate.
Yeah.
And it's hard to say, but I suppose they were the living ones, you know. You didn't know about the ones that had eaten the wrong mushrooms.
Yeah, no, exactly. Well, two people have texted in, including Zen from the Swamplands. Hi, Lindsay. Yeah. All fungi are edible, some of them only once.
Well, that is such a great quote. Yeah, we used to get the young folks down there picking, you know, the psilocybe type ones,
right?
And the old folks down there picking the great big they were big brown mushrooms, you know.
Yeah, maybe the milk caps, the ones that grow around pine mushrooms.
Yeah, we get them. You get them, but the big field mushrooms that used to grow in more on open grassland.
Right. Oh, great. Well, yeah, well, I'm about to talk to someone who should be able to tell us all about that as well, Dr. Tom May, who's a senior mycologist at the Royal Botanic Gardens in Victoria, just down the road from Mount Alexander Shire. But very good to talk to you, Anthony. Thank you very much.
Yep. By Australian standards, you beauty, and enjoy your lockdown.
Oh, and you too. Thank you, Anthony. Stay warm.
See you, mate.
But just before we talk to Dr. May, Sharon's on the line from Ballarat. Hello.
Oh, hello. How lovely to have you tonight from lovely Illawarra.
Oh, thank you. So how is Ballarat going? A little bit chilly, I imagine.
Freezing. Absolutely freezing cold. It hailed yesterday.
Wow.
Yeah, and the only reason it hasn't snowed is it hasn't stopped raining long enough to let it snow.
That is, it's not great weather. It's not great weather for mushroom picking.
No, it's, I think that my mushroom colonies on my family property are probably a little bit too mushy now.
Right.
Yeah, unfortunately I have lots of photos of them to look at.
And what memories did that bring back? Because you had some kind of bad memories.
Yes. Look, I wanted to talk about the good stuff, but very quickly, over 30 years ago, some of the mushrooms that were probably not the right kind of mushrooms, and nowadays we know not to do this, were picked by my parents and cooked up in a meal, and both my parents survived unscathed, but I was so sick they had to bring the doctor to me.
Ah.
I was in agony for days, and in those days they didn't send you off to the hospital for, you know, just anything. You had to be, you know, like that wasn't sick enough, you know. So I just had to ride out the pain until it got out of my system, and luckily I didn't die.
And you still have good stories about mushrooms.
I do. I started in childhood when I used to roam around looking for toadstools and getting the dandelions and blowing the seeds and then using the seeds to try and unlock the doors of the little fairies' homes.
Yeah.
But anyway... I'm studying architecture and I'm actually designing a complex multi-residential and commercial project, which may or may not happen, but it's designed to be on some land that we own. And the whole thing's based on mushrooms and underground mycelium networks.
Oh.
Now, it could be very tacky, and the reason I'm doing it is I had two other things which would have been much simpler to do for the project. My teacher said, do the heart, which is the hardest one. I said, it's going to be very hard to do mushrooms and not make it look tacky. And so she said, so you're doing that. And so the main building is three stories with a penthouse, like a tower, and if you were to... be underneath the base of the tapering slender tower and look up, you would see the gills of a mushroom underneath the underside of the penthouse.
Underneath, and then
the living pods are all dome shapes and other shapes that reference mushrooms.
Yeah.
And then there'll be an underground network. Because the other thing I love to do other than go up high on a building, because I love going up on heights, is I've done quite a bit of tunnelling underground in sewers of Ballarat and in the mines in Gippsland and things like that. So it's going to I've got a bit of a challenge because a door fell on me at university last year and my whole of my left side's injured. I can't do AutoCAD very well at the moment, so I'm drawing it all by hand. Fortunately, my right hand's fine.
Right. And so, you'll be drawing some underground compartments and tunnels?
Yeah, but that mainly, I don't know, I'm just not going to draw every single thing, but I'm also going to have a scale model, and then the scale model will be have miniature fairy lights and things, because it'll be lit up at night to do like a white night.
Oh, that's so lovely.
So, it could be disastrous or it could work.
Do you remember, British comedian Ross Noble, who lived in regional Victoria for a little while, the story I heard, and maybe it may not be accurate, but he had a house built in regional Victoria, and a guest house for his friends when they were coming and staying. And he had a secret tunnel, like a mycelial network, built between the two, purely so he'd they'd have dinner. Then they say goodnight to each other, and his friends would walk back along the ground to the guest house, and he would run underneath the secret tunnel, and so he could pop up and surprise them when they got there, and he'd already be in there.
Oh, he probably got that idea from Melbourne, because there's several secret tunnels between things like you probably heard the. It's not a rumour, that there was a secret tunnel from Parliament House to a certain brothel.
Oh, right. Yeah. I think this is used for a much less nefarious means.
But by the way, I've even got an outfit ready for the presentation, which referenced mushrooms, but in a way that won't make me look like an actual mushroom.
It's very nice to talk to you, Sharon. That's lovely.
It's lovely to talk to you. I better let you have some of your show back.
I will enjoy. I can't wait to see your when you do finish this.
I'll try to keep you in the loop when it happens.
Thank you so much, Sharon. Cheers.
Thank you. Cheers. Thanks for taking over the show tonight.
Don't worry.
Bye. Bye-bye. Thank you. Bye.
You are listening to Nightlife on ABC Radio across Australia. My name's Lindsay McDougall, sitting in the seat for Philip Clark just for today. And a lot of people very interested in talking about mushrooms and fungi. I would love to hear from you. 1-300-800-222, or you can text 0467-922-702. And on the line, a senior mycologist at the Royal Botanic Gardens Victoria, been working to identify and classify Australian fungi for almost 40 years, and the co-author of Wild Mushrooming, A Guide for Foragers. Hello, Dr. Tom May.
Good evening, Lindsay.
A lot of people very excited to talk about mushrooms. Are you finding that it's a bit of a renaissance for mushrooms?
Yeah, I definitely think there's something in the air. Merlin's book's been fantastic to kind of take fungi to a wider audience. But I think across a whole lot of areas, whether it's foraging or building things with mushroom or making things out of mushrooms or just discovering about the diversity, there really is a lot happening.
Yeah. We heard from Merlin all the things he finds amazing about fungi, and, obviously you can develop them into plans for houses, as we just heard then as well. But what is it about them that you find most intriguing?
Look, I think the thing that kind of really got me hooked when I first got really interested is just the diversity, and it's a kind of really hidden diversity. You could kind of walk through a forest a lot of months of the year and not really notice fungi much, but if you just happen to be there at the right time of year in early autumn, there's been a bit of rain, you'll just notice all these different colours and shapes and so on, and I was just really intrigued by that. When I was young, I was kind of spent a lot of time in the bush and was really interested in collecting butterflies and observing birds, and I just thought, wow, this is how a whole group of things, and there's lots of them, and that just set off a whole lot of questions.
So when did you start noticing the fungi growing out of everything?
Well, it was in the early 80s. I was living in, out of Mikulego in the Tindiri Ranges and on a farm, but backing onto the forest. So I used to go walking in the forest, just kind of getting to know the local flora and fauna. And it just must have been a good year. There were just fungi everywhere. And I kind of thought, oh, I'll just go and grab a book. Like, you know, there's a bird book and there's a plant book. But there really wasn't a guide that had all the different fungi in them. And I kind of, I mean, like many taxonomists, we're often quite obsessive. So I thought, I'll just make a bit of a list of fungi. So I got some index cards and I started to make a list. And eventually the index cards grew to about 2 metres. And that was the start of kind of a checklist of Australian fungi.
What were you looking at before then? What options were there to identify mushrooms?
Well, there was some good books that have been published quite a while back, one by John Cleland, who was a South Australian. He was actually a medical doctor, a pathologist, but he had lots of interest in natural history. He wrote a great book about toadstools and mushrooms of South Australia, and it had really good descriptions in it, but there weren't a lot of illustrations, so it took quite a lot of sort of detective work. You might find a green one. I have to go through the book and see which ones were green and what the characters were. And since that time, so this was in the early 80s, there's been a whole lot of fabulous field guides come out with coloured illustrations. And, you know, for photographers, fungi are really attractive. Oh, yeah. But at that time, there really wasn't anything with lots of coloured photos. So it was sort of reading these descriptions of all the different quite technical characters, lamellae attachment and annuluses and so on, and trying to match up what I saw. But often I couldn't match things up. And that was when I started to realise, look, a lot of the diversity hadn't actually been documented yet.
Yeah. I'm speaking to Dr. Tom May, who has documented that diversity. My wife's got a couple of great books about mushrooms. There's firstly A Field Guide to Australian Fungi by Bruce Fuhrer, and then there's All That the Rain Promises and More by David Arora. Now, do you remember the cover of that one?
Oh, yes. He brings quite a lot of comicness to fungi. So that's the one with the trombone. Yes, yes, he's that book's peppered with kind of funny jokes and so on. And he coined a whole lot of names for, like, you know, there's the tedious tuberia and then there's the totally tedious tuberia for all these little brown fungi that no one can tell them apart.
So he's in a suit, he's in a field, but in a suit, holding a bunch of fungi all joined together and holding a trombone, which is pretty nice, I think.
Yeah.
Pretty good. Talking about when you think, like, listening to all these different talks that talk about all these different mushrooms, how many species do we actually have in Australia? Like, do we have native mushrooms as well as introduced ones?
Oh, yeah, like our fungi are just as diverse as our flora and fauna, and there's a lot of unique fungi in Australia, and the diversity is enormous. So if we're talking about all the different sorts of fungi, we really have to estimate that, because very few of, you know, it's only a small proportion have been described. But there's between 50,000 and 250,000 different species of fungi just in Australia, but only 15,000 of them have been catalogued. About 5,000 of them are the big things, like mushrooms and coral fungi. Mm. We probably think there's at least twice as many as, even for the big things, there'd be twice as many as what we know. So there's a lot of work left for mycologists.
We were in Blangalow State Forest a few weeks ago now, back when we were allowed out, and the saffron milk caps had gone. They were all done. The slippery jacks were still around, but they're a bit too much work, so we didn't bother. But it struck me that these particular mushrooms, they have a relationship with the pine trees. Is it the same for Australian native fungi? Do they have these symbiotic relationships?
Yeah, absolutely. So we notice with these exotic fungi that are associated with exotic trees, like the saffron milk cap and the bright red fly agaric with the red spots, we see them under the exotic trees, which they form partnerships. But in the eucalypt forest or with casuarinas or with myrtle beech in the rainforest, there are the same sort of special relationships. So all across Australia, there are different kinds of fungi that are partnering up with native trees, swapping nutrients with them.
Yeah, right. So when pine trees came to Australia, did the botanists also have to bring the saffron milk caps and the slippery jacks with them?
It wasn't done deliberately in the early days. So I think a lot of the common plants that are growing in gardens and that would have come in through botanic gardens would have come in soil before we had kind of quarantine and biosecurity, yeah. And then fungi would have just hitchhiked in the soil.
Of course.
And when pine plantations were started to be put out in kind of, you know, large areas, there was actually some difficulty in getting the pines to grow properly. And at that point, there was enough knowledge about these so-called mycorrhizal fungi, these fungus root fungi, that some of them were actually deliberately introduced. And it's interesting with the saffron milk cap, there's not many records of that very early on. So that didn't seem to come in until the kind of the 20th century when the pine plantations were starting to be expanded. So yes, you really need the right fungi. The trees might sort of germinate and grow, but they won't really thrive. The fungi bring a whole lot of, they help with drought tolerance, they help protect the plants from pathogens and so on. So you really do need them, and there's very specific pairings. Wow. So the pines have particular fungi, the oaks have particular fungi and so on.
Yeah, right. Dr. Tom May is my guest. Lindsay McDougall is my name, sitting in for Phil Clark. Phil is fine. It's actually the ABC Ultimo Studios that need a little bit of work, not Philip. Philip's absolutely fine. And Don's on the line from Dubbo. Hello, Don.
Oh, good evening. Wonderful. So I've only tuned in the last 5 minutes or so, but when I was a lot younger, I was priding myself by cutting the mushrooms with a knife and thinking something would grow. Well, where I got that idea from, I don't know, but now if I go mushrooming, I'll leave one, say, in four to have some spore later on. And people have said, oh, that's risky eating mushrooms, but if you've been picking them for a lifetime, well, I'm very confident in what I pick and I make sure of what it is. And the last thing, this is tongue-in-cheek and just meant to be a light-hearted joke, a friend said to me, if you're picking your own mushrooms, leave some on the sink before you go to bed. Just leave a piece on the sink before you go to bed. Have you heard
that? That's excellent advice. As a scientist, I think I always recommend that, because in the, you know, the slight chance that something does go wrong, it's the identification that's really important. And look, as you say, if you're in a particular spot and you've got to know the local fungi, then usually things are okay. But it's often when people move around and they go somewhere a bit different and they see something that looks the same, there are actually, unfortunately, quite a lot of these look-alike fungi. But yep, I reckon keep a bit for the fridge. And then if you do happen to eat something and get sick, well, the only way we're going to be able to pin that down, the way the sort of science we add to the science, is if we can have a look at the specimen and identify
it. It's like knowing what spider bit you.
Well, if it doesn't sound too macabre, what she said to me is, if you leave that piece on the sink, they'll know what you died from.
There it is, Don. Well, hopefully what you just get a sore tummy from. Don, good to talk to you, mate. Hope you're okay.
Thank you.
Good on you. A couple of texts people are wondering as well, Dr. May. Someone here says, get your expert to comment on how fungi triggers allergic reactions. I suffer from sinus allergies, believed to be linked to fungi, says Mo from Canberra.
Well, the way fungi reproduce is spores, and spores are really tiny particles, kind of almost as fine as dust. So in the air, there's thousands of different spores all floating around. And yes, there are some different fungi that can trigger allergic reactions, but it's a bit like plants, you know. There'll be some plants in the garden that some individuals might be allergic to, but sort of as a whole, all fungi aren't kind of in the same basket there, and it's partly because there's so many different sorts. But yes, there are some molds that can trigger allergies.
Yeah, of course. Someone's asking, if fungi and trees are pairing, a symbiotic, is it bad for the trees for us to collect the fungi?
Well, I think that comes down to an understanding of the life cycle. So I like to call the mushrooms, rather than fruiting bodies, let's call them sporing bodies. So fungi are a separate kingdom, so we need different language for them. Mm. So their function is to produce spores. So they are like an apple on a tree. It's not the whole plant or the whole organism. So the fungus is growing out of fine threads, these hyphae that are in the soil. So as long as you don't disturb the ground and dig things up and trample and so on, especially if you're just slicing the fungus off, and you're not kind of over-harvesting, it's not disturbing the growing part of the fungus, which is in the soil, because that mushroom is transitory. They just come up for even just a couple of weeks dispersing the spores, and then that the growing part that's in the ground, the mycelium, that's persistent. It'll be there next year. It might even be there for hundreds of years. So I think the main thing, when I was working on the book with Alison Pulio, my co-author, we talked a lot about kind of approaches to foraging, and we came up with this approach of sort of ecological foraging. So it's sort of understanding the fungus in its environment, sort of being respectful, and just trying not to disturb. If you're going to be foraging out in the forest, just trying not to sort of disturb things too much.
Is that the slow mushrooming that you talk about in the book?
Yeah, well, the slow mushrooming is about the getting to know fungi, and it's particularly because, like, a very, you know, one of the most common questions from mycologists over the years that I get is, can I eat it? And I used to get really frustrated by that and say, there's so much more to fungi, you know, it's not just about eating them. But I worked with Alison on the book basically to provide an answer to that, which is, if you want to eat fungi, the best way to do it is to get to know them and to be able to identify them, because you can't just walk through the forest and say, well, that one looks good or that one looks bad. I mean, some yummy fungi look pretty weird, and some fungi that look innocuous can kill you. So you really have to know the fungus, know how to identify it, and that means actually getting to know all the different characters like lamellae and annulus and stipe and the variation there. It also means getting to know the toxic species just as much as the edible ones. And I think, look, we all love a free feed, and, you know, if a whole crop of mushrooms comes up on a nature strip, people often go, oh, yeah, that looks like, you know, that looks like something in the shop. And then, you know, they eat a whole lot, and often there's sort of bad consequences from that. So I think it's just taking it slowly and just starting with getting to know a couple of species. And I think that's the case with the saffron milkcaps. Excellent fungus to get to know straight up. They're in pine plantations, so straight away you're not disturbing any native forest if you're picking them. They're, you know, droves of them in the pine plantations, and they're really distinctive. There's a whole lot of things about them, the way they stain green, the orange colour, the juice, and so on. So it's like sort of like an identity kit. You want to tick off all those different characters, and you want to know the things that you could confuse them with. So just take it slowly. And I think too, We like it that foraging is a way that people come to fungi, but we also think there's a lot more to fungi, so that we hope sometimes people might go, well, I sort of was thinking about eating them, but actually, gee, they're really interesting. And there's a whole lot of other things there that would be good to know about, rather than just only focusing on the ones that you might eat.
Well, Georgie's texted in some that I don't think we're going to be eating. In Castella, northeast of Melbourne, this is a rather large fungi, red and white colouring that smells of rotten meat as it deteriorated. Could you identify that over the phone, Dr. May?
Well, red and white, look, the fly agaric is the classic one. And look, when fungi start to rot, they do smell atrocious. And it's one of the clues, actually, that fungi are in a different kingdom. They're not plants. They're actually more closely related to animals. So a closest relative of a mushroom is a human, not a plant. So when they rot, they really stink.
There is so much more to talk about, so much more to learn, which is why it's so exciting to have people like you on speed dial, Dr. May. As we mentioned, the book Wild Mushrooming, A Guide for Foragers, that you have co-written with Alison Pulio, is out now. We can learn all about it. We can slow mushroom. We can mushroom a little bit faster as we get better at it. And we can safely mushroom, which is really important. Dr. May, thank you so much for speaking to us today.
No worries.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.